There is no family that isn't dealing with some members who are aging. We have to figure out how to make our ordinary communities work for everyone, because our abilities change as we age.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, an architect by profession, the executive director of At Home with Growing Older, and the producer of this podcast. In our interviews, we explore the meaning of being at home with growing older from two angles: how we can adapt our living environments, including our cities, to better support us as we age, and how we can cultivate a sense of belonging within our communities and ourselves. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, architecture, medicine, social services, and beyond, and through comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you for being here. In this second episode in our series on changemakers, we are joined by Valerie Fletcher. Valerie is a pioneer and lifelong advocate for the power of inclusive and universal design, and is the longtime director of the Institute of Human-Centered Design in Boston. Together, we'll examine the value of interdependence and how individuals living with functional variations illuminate important lessons about ambiguity and resilience. And we'll consider how the universal experience of aging can unite us in pursuing a more inclusive world. Welcome, Valerie. We are so thrilled that you accepted our invitation.
Thank you so much, Susie. You know, I am delighted to talk to you at any opportunity. We always have wonderful conversations.
So true. Valerie, you have played a key role in redefining what design excellence truly means, focusing on universal and inclusive design. What is universal design? And what is inclusive design, and why have you made this your life's pursuit?
Thank you, Susie. I got lucky, Susie. My life had been divided between a life in design and a life of social justice. And in a bit of serendipity, way back in the fall of 97, this organization's founding director wanted to retire. And an old friend reached out, was on the board of directors, and said, "This is going to seem silly. It's a very small organization, but there's something here that you really need to understand. And I think this might be a place you need to be." So I had been in government. I had 5,400 staff. And I saw this, and it was universal design as a major concept, which had really just been created that year. The principles had been developed that summer. And this was the fall of the same year that we started a conversation. And I couldn't take my eyes off the opportunity. It was just the synthesis of the things I cared about. Design makes my blood run faster. I couldn't run away from that, but I couldn't live a life that didn't make a difference in the world. And so I got lucky, just got lucky. And this idea, back then we were calling it universal design. The Brits were calling it inclusive design pretty much about the same time. Was in many ways building on an increasingly clear understanding of accessibility as a baseline. It was the idea that accessibility, when you did it well, actually changed the experience of everyone for the better. And that was really the very simple idea at the start of it. Ron Mace was one of the key thinkers in the world at the very start of it. Tragically, Ron died in 98, so it was a very short arc for a remarkable fellow. And Ron had had polio as a boy, and so he was a chair user. He and Selwyn Goldsmith in London, another architect who had had polio at a completely different point in life. Selwyn, when he was getting licensed as a young man in his mid-20s, and for Ron, went to architecture school already with a significant disability. But these were guys saying, no, it's not about me. It's about what design can do to bring us together and to create a world in which it is just normal to anticipate difference of ability. So that was then. Those early years, we hosted an international conference in June of 98 in New York with the UN as a partner. And we were the primary host. There was a variety of other organizations. And we were shocked that 30 countries showed up. And they were all having the same idea at the same time. It was thrilling, thrilling. The idea was that we were extraordinarily fortunate in the 20th century to dramatically reduce reasons for dying young. We reduced childhood mortality dramatically. That people with disabilities were no longer condemned to a life in which, if they were lucky, they lived to be young adults, but they didn't live to be old. And suddenly we had a world in which our success, largely born of health innovation, created a situation in which we lived longer and survived more than ever before in human history. It was a thrilling notion. But in order to make it work, we had to have design that anticipated this new reality. And that was how we thought of it. So issues of aging were very central at the beginning. When I look back on those early days, I almost am astonished that we were a bit naive, that these things didn't fall equally on everyone, that the advantage was actually for the lucky, for the privileged, in a way much more reliably predictable than it was for everyone. But it started out there. And it was not special and separate. You had to anticipate the ordinariness of difference in ability across a spectrum of physical, sensory, brain, and chronic health condition.
What an amazing, exciting start to this endeavor, Valerie.
It was thrilling partly because the world was having this conversation. It was almost like an intuitive sense of this is what we must do.
Yeah, as we now live in a world where the lifespan and the health span of people in older age has increased dramatically. This is coming full circle because we all need an environment that supports us and enables us to participate in public life, to live longer in our homes, etc. What I also wanted to ask you, Valerie, is inclusive and universal design. When people think about it, they often think about mobility, but there is so much more to it. I wonder if you can just give a couple of concrete design examples and how functional variations can be enabled through design.
And Susie, let me take a second to just point out that we are an educational and design nonprofit. When I first came into the organization, it was this explosive growth of the movement. And the idea of doing global convening was a big priority. And so a conference in 98 in New York, a conference in 2000 in Providence with RISD, a conference in 2002 in a burgeoning movement in Japan, led by the big Japanese multinationals. And that was in Yokohama. 2 years after that, I really felt we needed to be in the Global South because we had participants from the Global South. We ended up in Rio de Janeiro that year, 2004. Again, you know, I think we had 32 countries participating, a massive effort. We had 8 tracks of sessions. And then 2 years after that, back to Kyoto, Japan. I had to really grapple with the fact that a small organization could be a convener or they could choose to be something else. And for us, practice became a priority. We had to prove that this was real, that this wasn't just a set of concepts. This was truly capable of transforming real places. So from 2006 right through to the present, we have been very much focused on practice, and we have portfolios in many different environments. We have been very, very fortunate to have extraordinary clients from coast to coast. We have learned so much in those collaborations. So we are deep content experts in inclusive design and accessibility. Accessibility is a focus on a much more narrow set of reasons for functional limitation. In the United States, we were the first country to really codify all of that. And the focus, remember, this was a post-polio world in which wheelchair users were not only numerous, but they were leaders. It isn't that people were designing these standards for them. They were designing these standards. It was people with that lived experience who were the ones who were creating the standards, certainly 504 starting in 78, then eventually the ADA in 1990. But it was leaders whose lived experience was about that. But today, we have a very different profile. And one of the priorities of our organization is to educate designers about who do you design for? And I think it's critically important that people understand, even when we're talking about mobility, we're not talking only about people who use wheeled mobility, a wheelchair or a scooter. We're talking about 10 times that number who have difficulty walking. There are very few standards about that. And they certainly benefit from baseline accessibility. You know, where would we be without the curb cut? Where would we be without ramps? However, it's not enough. It doesn't include things like a place to sit. From my experience, people with difficulty walking need a place to sit regularly in order to be engaged in the community, in order to do what they need to do, just as a simple, simple response. We also know as we age, we are more likely to have sensory limitations. And again, the standards are only a low, low bar. They pay very little attention to the majority experience. We have more attention paid to people who use Braille, for example. Only 10% of people who are legally blind in the United States use Braille. We need to be thinking about different kinds of realities that work for people with low vision, which is far more dominant. And we need to recognize, what are the reasons for blindness in America today? The dominant reason for blindness in America is diabetic retinopathy. It takes a long time to actually lose your sight. But the communities with epidemic rates of diabetes are the Black and the Latino community, with increasing numbers in the Asian community. These are realities about disability intersecting with culture that we need to be aware of. The phenomenon of hearing loss is something that is now reaching way younger in life. The people who are now taking advantage of much more sophisticated hearing aids are 35 to 50, not 55 to the end of life. So we have different patterns occurring. Part of that is culture and society and different ways in which we damage our ears. But I think we need to be looking at, who do you design for? And I think one of the least attended aspects of this is a spectrum of differences in how our brains work. And that is certainly critical to children, to youth, but also across the course of life. It is mental health issues. It is neurodiversity, from dyslexia to ADHD to autism spectrum disorder. And for older people, never diagnosed. People may have heard about Bill Gates' new book, in which he basically acknowledges that if it was a different time, he would have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And he still does movements that we would call stimming. It also illustrates how important it is to figure out a world in which people like that can thrive. Brains that work differently are brains that are often gifted in innovation.
So Valerie, if somebody listens to this, they would think, how can we design for such a huge range of abilities? What would you tell them?
Well, one of the things I can tell them is that we are bent on sharing that information much more expansively. One of the challenges of doing our consulting and design work, however satisfying and meaningful it is, and however much we've learned, most of it is in the context of non-disclosure agreements with our clients. And we have portfolios in some wonderfully appealing aspects of the built environment. They include higher ed, public transit. We do a great deal of work with municipalities. We do outdoor recreation of all kinds, from very large federal parks to very small playgrounds in cities and towns. We are deeply committed to our work with museums. We're working on our 96th museum, but that is thrilling to us. Those are people who are often really committed to raise the bar in an increasingly multi-sensory experience of museums. Susie, when you and I met in San Francisco, we were talking about the phenomenon of the inadequacy of guidance for housing people who are unhoused in SROs and the extraordinary work that you've been doing in terms of homes that people do not own but rent. And how do you figure out, a retrofit that makes those places work for all of our lives, or multifamily housing, and to go back to accessibility as the only tool for doing housing that really facilitates our experience and our independence and autonomy. We need to have better guidance on environments that are designed to anticipate difference in how our senses and brains and our systems work. The chronic health conditions are so pervasive. We have to be thinking of that. And we believe, and we have data to prove, that we can make that difference.
Yes, I totally agree. And, you know, what's been amazing to us in our work with the workshops, but also just for me as an architect, it really doesn't take that much to design an inclusive environment. It's really very much about understanding the needs of who uses the space. And I'm just thinking of simple things like signage, both in pictorial and words, so it can be understood in different ways. Giving people choices in little ways how they live in their home.
And Susie, I think that your focus on choice is so important. It's important to affirm for ourselves that we know it makes a difference if you have choice and a sense of control. We are hopelessly followers and fans and groupies of neuroscience and how explosive the growth of neuroscience has been and how much it's told us about what we need for our brains to work better, what we need to feel well and at our best. In absent choice and a sense of control, we are not at our best.
Yes, maybe this is a good segue to talking a little bit about interdependence as a true asset. We mostly talk about independence as something to strive for, but you have always talked about the power of interdependence in designing an inclusive world.
I would love to delve into that a little bit, Susie. Part of it is that historically, people have understood interdependence as a starting point for thinking about a view of the world that made sense. And I think if we look at Indigenous people in much of the world, this idea of our relationship to one another and to nature was not debatable. It wasn't something we chose. It was something that was inherent to reality of life. And I think we've gotten very far from it. In our culture right now, we've got an overarching emphasis on self and ego and success and merit. And in truth, it flies in the face of the evidence that we are connected naturally and inherently. And when we break ourselves apart as unique and about only ourselves, life is poorer overall. We cannot afford to give people a sense that that is the only way to live and the only way to be happy. And I think many of us were educated with Maslow's hierarchy of need. One of the things that I've been really trying to drive home to people is that notion of self-actualization, which is very pervasive in American culture, that that is the highest good. Maslow himself actually recognized later in his life that that wasn't actually the highest good, that self-forgetting was actually a far higher achievement. What we can do to transform our shared lives. Forgetting ourselves is a higher order than realizing ourselves. And I think we have to get back to finding a way to that and finding a way to recognize that we are at our best when we embrace that notion of interdependence.
Interdependence can flourish when people are out in public life, when they interact with the environment, when they interact with each other.
You wrote a wonderful essay this week for those of us that are lucky enough to be subscribers. And it was that notion of these small exchanges, being open and aware of intersecting with people on the street, of stepping up if somebody needs a hand. I happen to live in a frozen environment right now. It's been a tough winter in the Northeast. And we had a big mess of a storm on the weekend. It all turned to slush and then it froze into bumpy, impossible ice. Everyone is struggling. So putting an arm out for people making their way just down the street, across the road, is actually something that is readily done. And it is a small satisfaction, but it begins to knit us together as communities, as people who recognize one another, as shared need. We can't create inclusive environments without thinking of humans as part of creating facilitating environments. It is how we interact with one another. I'm so tired of people who are blocked from interacting on the street because they are blocked from even hearing or seeing anyone else, self-concerned and self-contained. And I think it's a loss that we have to begin to recognize is a problem.
Yes, it is. I have gotten used to it now that I can't just say hi to somebody and expect a response because somebody might be plugged into a different world. It is a loss. I totally agree.
Susie, if I might just point out, it is important for us to remember that there are parts of the country that live differently. So we are lucky to work in different parts of the country. And though I might think I have nothing in common with people in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we are working with a fabulous client, a major research university in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I was down there a few weeks ago, and people greet each other as just a norm in a way that we don't on the coasts. We don't do it as often. But in the Deep South, people still greet one another as strangers, but they greet one another. So I think it's one of the things that we need to learn in figuring out how do we learn new ways of telling stories and talking to one another. But I was pleased. I was even pleased for total strangers calling me honey, which I would be offended by most of the time. But in this world today, in a place where I know no one, it was welcome.
Thanks for sharing this story. So something you do really well in your work is supporting young people in their mission of human equality. In general, how can we as older adults learn from, you know, the younger generation and support them in their mission?
Susie, I am so heartened by young people today and by young designers in particular. It wasn't that long ago that everybody thought they would be a star architect. You know, that if they just applied themselves, one day they would be famous. They would be in the design magazines. The luster is off that idea. Now people are looking for lives that give them an opportunity to change people's lives for the better. And they aren't necessarily getting that training that they need in design school. But they are out there as seekers trying to figure that out. And we are deeply committed to our program to bring young people in as interns and co-ops and fellows and sometimes doctoral candidates or postdocs and give them an opportunity to share in our work, to really test themselves, put themselves at risk, trying new things. Part of that always involves working with people with lived experience, what we call user experts, who share their time and their lived experience in being part of the evaluation of the environments that we work in. You'll love the idea that right now we're working with a library that has such bad wayfinding that the librarians have thrown up their hands and said, please help us figure this out. And what we're going to do is do it with user experts, spending a couple of hours in the library like anyone else would do, except we're going to document what works, what fails, and what they think might work better. We're doing that also in the streets of Boston, looking at the pedestrian bicycle or alternative wheeled mobility bike lanes that are now being used by electrified vehicles in huge numbers. And we're always talking about bikes and cars, and we have somehow forgotten the conversation we have to have about pedestrians and bike lanes, because bike lanes are fundamentally different. You and I are both bike riders, but we use our legs in the old-fashioned way. Today, we've got people going 25 miles an hour in the bike lane, paying no attention to the fact that many people, especially older people, who may have no visible limitation, may have a tough time hearing you coming or getting out of the way.
So what could one say to bicyclists to interact with them in a constructive way, to say, hey, we are sharing this environment.
I think we've been pretending that things haven't changed dramatically with the introduction of electric everything. I don't know how many models of electric scooters there are, but there seem to be somewhere between 15 and 30, and they're constantly proliferating. And it isn't that it isn't a brilliant way to get around, but it has to come with an understanding of that interdependence and to recognize that you don't know the limitations of someone standing and waiting to cross the bike lane. Because at this point, you can't cross the street without crossing bike lanes. You can't get to the bus stop or off the bus stop without crossing bike lanes. And we need people to recognize it. A part of the world in which this has been normal for a long time. Copenhagen, this sort of motherlode of the thinking on the integration of bikes in the city. And the problems are not the same. It's partly because there is this different notion of interdependence that applies a certain grace to what we expect of sharing the street. We need to learn to do that.
Yes, and I think we, as older adults, if I may sort of use this umbrella term, we have a role in this. I would love to dig a little deeper into how this universal experience of aging, which was at the beginning of universal design, can become a catalyst for a more inclusive world. How can this unique situation we are in right now help everybody?
I believe it's possible. I believe it's possible because there is no family that isn't dealing with some members who are aging. This is not about them over there. This is about us, if we understand it, at least at the level of family. And I think we have to start telling stories about how we have no solutions in which older people somehow are magically accommodated in a world that is not the world the rest of us live in. We know that is ridiculous. And there is only a few solutions for people with the means to pay for it. We have to figure out how to make our ordinary communities work for everyone. And we are going to be watching a steady increase up to 2060. We've got 100 million people who'll be over 65 in 2060. This isn't special or separate. This is about every street, every town, every event, every destination has got to anticipate the ordinariness of that range of ability. Because our abilities change as we age. 40% of people over 65 have a disability. Most of them would not raise their hand and say, I'm one of them. But, you know, I'm 73. I don't think of myself as a person with a disability. I have the ordinary realities of aging. I have old injuries that now become daily companions. I have rheumatoid arthritis like so many other people. I can't open a bottle or a can without tools. I have macular degeneration. We monitor it. It's not moving so quickly that I'm losing my sight too dramatically. These are just ordinary. You know, these are perfectly predictable aspects of aging, and I don't want them to get in my way. And that's pretty much where everybody is. I don't want them to be in my way. I want to be able to anticipate that I am welcome wherever I go, and I can make it work, ask for help, find things that might be necessary to modify an environment so that I can enjoy myself. I am not keen on climbing loads of stairs. My knees and hips hurt. That isn't anything I can do easily anymore. But it doesn't mean I stop going.
We talk about this also in our workshops. We use the term aging as an extreme sport. And we need the same tools as athletes because it's a very similar endeavor, and we should have the same expectations for design excellence. So there is this big group of people who hopefully will have more and more confidence in speaking up and asking for an environment which actually enables them and protest if this is not the case.
And I think you've been very clear about where aesthetics intersects with these aspirations. That this is not about homely as the answer. It is about using our opportunity to design environments that also deliver our need to be moved, by beauty and by the physical environment. And it doesn't even have to be visual. We do a lot of work with people who are blind and low vision. You know, I so appreciate an appetite for aesthetics and for that sensory experience that really delivers delight. And it's so doable. We can get there, but we have to embrace it as doable. For someone like myself, my obsession is how do we inspire people to know, what do we know now? Where is the bar? And how do we give them those tools so they don't waste time and energy hitting the same old bar? Let's go beyond that. But we've got to share existing knowledge in order to entice people to go beyond it.
So how do we best share existing knowledge? Because there seems to be a big gap between knowledge and how individuals can access it.
It is incumbent on organizations like ours, who've been doing this work for such a long time and have learned so much from practice, have learned so much from gathering the standards for accessibility and the guidelines for inclusive design from across the world. We can make an error that sometimes we imagine the United States is always at the front of the parade. We aren't always at the front of the parade. We look at the International Standards Organization. They had a terrific guide on cognitive ergonomics almost a decade ago. We have an excellent guide from the British Standards Organization that doesn't answer all the questions, but boy, there's a load of good ideas in there on design for neurodiversity. We need to begin to give people a sense of there are precedents elsewhere that can inform what we do here. Let me give you a super simple example from England. England has, as a standard, glass manifestation, basically making sure people don't face plant into plate glass walls and doors and windows or enclosures for rooms, which are very popular and understandable and they're delightful. But if you are distracted, if your sight is less than perfect, you are completely vulnerable to planting your face in that plate glass. Not a pretty picture. And the Brits have for years had a requirement of glass manifestation at two levels. It doesn't have to be a certain thing. Just has to be something that's discernible. And it can be an opportunity to integrate an artful feature in the environment that also keeps you from face planting.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
I will open this up to everybody to share some experiences from their professional or personal practice about universal design or lack of universal design and inclusive design.
Susie, if I might just clarify why we shifted our language to inclusive design. Universal design was our first embrace. We were part of only five organizations from the United States that developed the principles of universal design. It was only after some years of use of that term that I was concerned that it had been dismissed by many people as no more than a bit of steamed milk on the coffee of accessibility. And it was a much bigger idea. The other aspect of it that was potentially problematic, not inherently, but potentially, is that it sounded like there was a holy grail and we would reach that grail one day. Not the case. We know from things like long COVID that we have to constantly be learning what does it take in order to create a world that everyone can live in together. So inclusive design is more descriptive of the aspiration that we are constantly figuring out. Who do we design for?
Thank you, Valerie. So Ricardo just recently was a wonderful guest on our podcast. He is also on the board of the Institute for Human-Centered Design.
And he was our first intern in 1978.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, indeed.
Hello, Valerie, and thank you, Susie, for hosting. Related to the notion of inclusive design, I was very re-inspired and invigorated by a session I attended on health and wellness and about inclusion by Genentech. They were very adamant about challenging this contention about diversity, disability, inclusion, And they talked about the value of it and the benefits of it, and that it wasn't about finding another term, but really letting everyone know that everybody is involved and engaged and beneficial of this notion of inclusive design, universal design, and everything in between, from equity to diversity. In my kind of post-retirement, I'm still advocating for life-centered design across the lifespan, and I'm trying to be even more inclusive of everything I do, from sustainable issues of the environment and the economy, as well as ways in which we can enhance designing a difference. And serendipity of attending this networking event at the Genentech headquarters in South San Francisco, I sat down next to these young folks who turned out to be recent graduates from UC Berkeley. One student sitting next to me was a public health major, but had taken design classes and sessions in the Jacobs Innovation Center. And it just really, again, invigorated me on how important design is as a tool and as an instrument and as a vehicle for enhancing all that we do and all who we serve. So it's not just a design thing, but it's really about making design more transparent, more widespread, doing many of the things that you're doing, Susie, with At Home with Growing Older, many of the things that Valerie's doing in leading the Institute for Human-Centered Design, and the things I continue to do on an academic and on a community service level. And I say this because 2 weeks earlier, I attended an event and the tagline was inequality and how we can better design. However, three of the panelists were very apologetic and somewhat covert about advocating for diversity and inclusion. And I was the last person in the audience to speak. And I was really getting itchy in my seat because I was irritated by the fact that designers have been downplaying DEI in their efforts to want to conform. And I said, no, I think we really need to take a stand.
Ricardo, you are the best storyteller I know. So we can all learn from you. I would like to give Valerie a chance to respond to this.
One of the things that, and Ricardo knows, that I am pretty focused on this issue. It is actually policy from the World Health Organization. It's difficult to talk about anything that doesn't somehow have a political stain on it right now. But we have been working with the World Health Organization definition of disability since it was first issued in 2001, so 24 years ago. It is really important to this conversation because it was reflective of a change in how we think about disability, that it doesn't reside in the individual. It occurs at the intersection of the individual and their environment. And they were smart enough, even 24 years ago, to say it's a holistic understanding of the environment. It's physical, certainly, but it is also the information environment, that wayfinding point. That is the communication environment. We think about our sensory vulnerabilities and whether it's distraction or it is loss of acuity in our sight or hearing. It is policy and it is attitude that comprises the context that needs to be facilitated for everyone to participate. That notion of context is really important because it's at that intersection that things either work or fail. And for us to focus on how do we make that interface work, make the context work, those of us who design are makers of the human context. That's a big job. And to get people to recognize this isn't about how it looks. It's about that intersection of a human. Our old friend Ray Lifshay at Cal talking about design architecture as a social art. It is not sculpture. It does not hang on the wall. And I think we need to constantly remind ourselves of our power as designers to create the context of life itself for people.
That was fantastic, Valerie. Thank you for clarifying this. Chao, thank you for your patience.
Hello, I'm an occupational therapist and former intern with Valerie from 2012.
I was going to say it's been a long time.
Been a long time, yes. So I wanted to comment on, Valerie's voice has been so consistent over these years, and that's so important. And for me to have experienced that and for her to take me on as a student and welcome me with open arms, and how that prepared me to continue the advocacy that I do and to be comfortable and confident with collaborating with people outside of healthcare. And she truly nurtured that, and it's helped me work with other designers and seek out other opportunities and really give me this confidence and the skills that I can make change wherever I am. I'm currently in New York City working at a school for kids and young adults with cerebral palsy. OT has so many similarities. We want to make people's lives better and have people express themselves the way they want to and empower everyone. And to bring that universal design component, having that experience has been pretty incredible. So thank you.
I can't thank you enough, Chad. That's so heartening.
I even take on design interns as well now. So that's definitely helped me, I think, having that modeled to me and being that change. So thank you. That's just what I wanted to say.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Chad.
Valerie, do you want to respond to this testimony to your ability to create change makers?
It's giving people a sense that this is a risk worth taking. There aren't rules here. This is really about an earnest, sincere effort to understand what works, what fails, what people need and want. And it is deeply satisfying, as Chow was describing. She's clearly just run with it. You know, that's what we really want people to do. Chow, you'll be happy to know, as usual, we have two doctoral candidates in OT working with us this semester, as we do every spring. It's really deeply satisfying to us also.
Risk worth taking, yes.
The risk-taking part is absolutely critical, and it's part of giving people a sense that it isn't about rules, it's about thinking differently, about, you know, creating those intersections. We've talked a lot about sharing information. I'm going to make a pitch for colleagues in France. They were the people who did the signage and wayfinding program for the Paris Olympics and Paralympics. And they're old friends, Okine, and they now own Tactile also. And they did a multi-sensory system. They spent 18 months testing it with people across the lifespan with all kinds of disabilities in order to figure out iteratively what works, what really works. And then at the end, they basically confirmed this is the system that we're going to use. And then they created a guide that they have given away. So I have it in English and French. I'm happy to share that. But it is not only about this is what we ended up doing in terms of a system. This is how we engaged people in the process. And we need many more people to tell those stories.
Thank you, Valerie. I think that's a wonderful end to such a rich conversation. I know that we will continue these conversations onwards. I also want to say that, you know, you have been one of the key inspirations for me to do what I'm doing with much tenacity and also optimism, because you embody optimism that we can make change. I also hope that we can encourage everybody, because everybody can make change in their own home, even if it's just a small and simple seeming change, it makes a difference. So we are all change makers in our own rights.
Anyone who can imagine that what is could be better.
Exactly it. Thank you again, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Susie. Enjoyed being with you.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.